thanks for the introduction and thanks for inviting me. So yeah, I will talk about mergers of compact objects and how we can model the electromagnetic signatures from these objects. And of course, this is a very broad subject, so I will talk about two types of systems. So I will talk about supermassive black hole binaries, work I've been doing in collaboration with people at RIT and other places. And in the second part of the talk, I will talk about binary star mergers, which I'm doing a collaboration with Daniel here. So yeah, so as Daniel said, these are two very these are two multi-messenger systems. So they emit gravitational waves and electromagnetic waves in principle, but they live at very different scales. So supermassive black hole binaries have millions and millions of solar masses, and so the gravitational waves can be detected with in principle with LISA and with eventually with LISA and pulsar timing arrays, because the wavelengths of these gravitational waves are extremely long, or the frequencies are extremely short, right? And the important difference here is that perhaps that we don't have yet any confirmed source of a supermassive black hole binary. There are a few candidates, but as far as I know, it's still a little bit controversial. Well, binary star mergers, we of course we already know that they exist, and were detected by LIGO and Virgo, also with electromagnetic telescopes. So yeah, so these are very different systems, but it's very interesting, and there are shared techniques that we can use to study them. We need general relativity, we need MHD and other things. So I will start talking about the first part, supermassive black hole binaries, the work I've been doing, trying to model the systems through GR-MHD simulations. And I know that perhaps you, most likely you know more than I do in this subject, but I'll start to give some context here. So supermassive black holes binaries are expected to form when two galaxies merge. If each supermassive black hole managed to reach close separations of milliparsecs or so, then gravitational wave radiation becomes efficient, and the system can merge in a small amount of time. So the system go through a cycle where first the galaxies found each other, and then through different processes the black holes can encounter, and if they manage to get to the separations, we'll get gravitational waves from that we can detect in principle with pulsar timing arrays in the spiral and with LISA in the final stages of the merge. So also a very interesting difference between supermassive binary black holes and stellar mass black holes is that these systems will be living in the gas-rich environment of the galaxy, and they will be very massive, right? So accretion can occur if they manage to accrete at similar rates as we know supermassive black holes do in AGNs, then the systems will be detectable with electromagnetic waves. So this is a multi-messenger system. Now, what's the challenge here? So the challenge is that the systems are very small compared to the entire galaxy, right? And it's very hard to observe them individually. And so we have to rely on other on observables, And the problem is, how do we distinguish normal HENs, where you have only a single black hole, and a binary? So you have to know accurately how what do you expect from this system in terms of electromagnetic signatures. And this is something we can do in a couple of years or even now, in contrast with gravitational waves, which will have to wait a decade or so when LISA will be hopefully observing. So this is something we can, if we have good models of electromagnetic signatures from these systems, we can hope to find them. So we have to know what kind of variability and spectral features we expect from these systems. And depending on the stage of the system, because the entire process from merger to from the merger of galaxies until the merger of the binary black holes are they go through very different processes and stages of evolution. So we will have to focus on what we want to study here, and that imply essentially using different techniques, right? So if the separation is large, for instance, you can use Newtonian physics to describe the evolution of the disk and the matter around the binary. But once you get to very close separations, then general relativity becomes important, right? So I will focus on this part here, where the supermassive black holes are close to each other and they are emitting gravitational waves. So perhaps the only way to study the systems is through simulations, because the whole all the physical processes there are extremely non-linear, right? So we need simulations, kind of a laboratory to understand what is going on here.
Can I just throw in a question?
Yeah, of course. Sorry, I didn't say, but please interrupt me whenever you want. Yeah,
just before you move on to those three, let's say the right-hand side, I was just wondering, for this viscous hydro part that you have on the left-hand side, do you know whether people use this fluid gravity duality in that area?
No, not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay, I'm just asking because I'm trying to understand whether people use this for numerical simulations, this duality, but okay.
All right. Yeah, I don't know if anyone wants to jump in. I understand that this kind of viscous hydro are just hydro simulations with fictitious viscosity. Not fictitious, but like alpha viscosity or dynamical viscosity, that you can put some stresses there and have some accretion. That's what I understand from the simulations. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. So when the black holes, as I was saying, when the black holes are very close to each other, general relativity becomes important. We need simulations, and there are a few challenges here to model this type of systems. The first one I should say is that you have very different timescales, which is always challenging in computational astrophysics, right? So in this system, we have the circumbinary disk. So we have the viscous timescales of the circumbinary disk that surrounds, I hope you can see my pointer. So that surrounds the binary. And then we have what happens with the gas around each individual black hole. And also we have the propagation in principle of outflows and magnetic and hydro outflows from the system. So it's very challenging to take into account all these timescales properly. So there are several interesting questions here. So for instance, how much accretion is there in the stage where the black holes are very close to each other? What is the effect of the spin? Because we expect that black holes, the supermassive black holes have to have spin. So what is the effect on the on this on the accretion, given that the system is very dynamical? And also, more importantly, perhaps, is what are the variability signatures? Because we expect that the electromagnetic emission will have some imprint of the binary motion, right? So how do we find this variability in the simulations and in the gas, and how we can translate that into electromagnetic observables? And this is basically what I've been doing. So to be more precise, I've been investigating accretion onto spinning supermassive binary black holes that are close to merger. And we are trying to obtain concrete, that is like observables like light curves and spectra and this type of observables. So we follow a number of steps in different works that, as I said, I have developed with in collaboration with people at RIT and Johns Hopkins and NASA. And so in the first part, we need a general relativity. We need a space-time for spinning binary black holes. Of course, we can solve Einstein's equation, but given that the separation is not too short, so we are focusing on separations that are like 20 m or above 20 m. So you have gravitational wave emission, but you're not too close to the merger. So you can, in principle, use approximated methods here to model the spacetime. And since the amount of gas in the system is not comparable to the huge masses of the black hole, you don't have to take the coupling of the spacetime and the gas into account, right? So I will give more details, but we built an approximated spacetime from the for this spinning black holes. Then we do some we did some long-term evolution, long-terms in scales of GRMHD simulations, that is more than 100 orbits or 300 orbits or so, which are still an order of magnitude less than what you can do with viscous Newtonian simulations, right? But for GRMHD, as far as I know, these are the longest simulations of the supermicro disk. And then so this is for the supermicro disk, and then we simulate what happens near the black hole. I'm going to show this in a few slices. And finally, we use the results of these simulations to do ray tracing and follow the photons out of the system and find spectra and light curves and this concrete observable. So this is still working. This last part is in preparation, but I will show some preliminary results. So let me start with the first part. So as I said, we are using an approximation for the metric, which is very simple and very computationally efficient. So what we're doing is we are building our metric of the binary spacetime in two parts. So we are proposing a superposition of black holes, and we are applying a time-dependent boost. So you have these two terms, linear terms here, moving around the center of mass. And we are using the post-Newtonian trajectories, including spin coupling and all the terms up to, I think, 3.5 p.m. order. So this metric is different from what you have in the typical post-Newtonian metric, where it's only valid away from the black hole. So here, if you put this superposition, you can have the horizon and all the strong gravity effects near the black hole, and you also have this motion that is taking into account with the post-Newtonian trajectories. So in the first part, we tested the metric. We tested comparing the metric with other approaches, with other metrics that are like a matching approach and other types of metrics. So in the first work, we saw that the metric behaves fairly well up to separations than larger than 50 m, where everything, the post-Newtonian trajectories and the post-Newtonian approach breaks down. So this is what we do in the first work. We tested this metric and we saw that it behaves properly. And now we have this metric to use in MHG simulation. So we put this as a background, and then we evolve the fluid on the background of this metric. So this is what we do. And in the first MHG simulation we did, we evolve with the code Harm3D, a full 3D GR MHG simulation of just the circumbinary disk. So we are excising the black hole region here, and we are evolving the whole fluid around this. And so the goal of this work was to see if the spin of the black hole have some effect in the cavity, and if this effect can somehow propagates into the circumbinary disk. And also another thing we wanted to do here is to evolve for many, many long time until we reach some steady state. So you can see here, I should say steady state, at least in the inner part of the disk, right? So so this is what we do. We evolve for almost 300 orbits. So most of previous simulations stop around here. So we continue the simulation, and we saw that the accretion rate and other quantities stabilized at this number of orbits. And this seems to, we tested this with different types of configurations. And we also saw that if you have aligned spins of 0.9, then the frame dragging effect will decrease the amount of matter that falls into the binary for tens of percent. So the effect is of course not too large as expected. And also we proved that the bulk properties of the circumbinary disk are not affected if you change the spin of the black holes, at least for anti-aligned and aligned spins. So this is what we did in the first simulations. And then, as I said before, we wanted to, the most interesting part is to see what happens with the plasma that orbits around the black hole when the black holes have spin. So we compare spinning and non-spinning simulations of circumbinary disk and accretion disk, a mini disk accretion. And in order to get realistic initial data for the circumbinary disk and not have to evolve the entire system, that would be too computationally expensive, we took one of the previous simulations that only the circumbinary disk was evolved, and we used this as initial data. So you start with a already stabilized or the or a steady state disk, right? And we did that with spinning and non-spinning black holes, and we found some interesting results with this. So the first thing is that spinning black holes, in comparison with non-spinning black holes, have more mass. The mini disk of each black hole have more mass. So I should say, sorry, I didn't say it, but what the, you know, the whole dynamics is that you have the circumbinary disk, and the black holes, when they pass, you know, near the inner edge of the circumbinary, they will accrete and they will form a mini disk if the fluid has enough angular momentum, right? And if you have spinning black holes, the ISCO of the black hole is closer to the black hole, so you can have more mass orbiting close to the black hole. So in, you know, in a cycle of the system, you can have more mass in the case of the spinning black holes. And so this is the first result that we had. So spinning black holes.
Sorry. So if you have anti-aligned spins, so you expect less mass the mini disk than the zero spin case then?
Right. Yeah. So yeah, let me move to the other slide. So exactly. So we are assuming that the black holes are moving in the direction of the circumbinary disk. So most of the mass comes here, right? And in that case, if you have spinning black holes, the ISCO is closer to the black hole than if you have non-spinning black holes. But if you have anti-aligned spins, then what happens is that the ISCO is even larger than the non-spinning case. So in the case of anti-aligned, we haven't simulated this, but there is a recent paper by Pascavilis that showed that if you have anti-aligned spin, then you don't form almost any mini disk because the mass cannot, there is not enough mass that can orbit the black hole, right? So maybe I can explain this a little better. So when you have a binary, you have two scales that are important. You have the ISCO that is determined by the spin, and you have what is called the truncation radius. So the truncation radius is like the maximum radius where you can have orbiting particles. And this is because you have the gravity effect of the companion, right? So this happens in most binary systems. So so if you have, as I said before, if you have an ISCO that is closer to the black hole, then you have more mass that is able to orbit each black hole. So, and if you have an ISCO that is larger, then you have less mass because most of the mass will just falls directly from the circumbinary into the black hole. Another interesting thing is that the accretion rate, if you measure the accretion rate onto one of the black holes, this will have a clear periodicity. And this periodicity is comes from the circumbinary disk. And this is because in equal mass, with a mass ratio of one, let's say, the circumbinary, what is found in most simulations is that the circumbinary disk forms this structure here that is called the lump. So this is like a structure that orbits the inner edge. It's like an overdensity that orbits the inner edge of the circumbinary disk. And this is where most of the accretion is happening, you see? So accretion happens when one of the black holes passes near this overdensity. And this is imprinted essentially in the accretion rate. So when the black hole passes near this overdensity, then it will accrete, and this accretion will be, and this accretion will have the variability of the frequency of this over density here. And
so sorry, that's essentially because the viscous time scale in these mini disks is comparable to the feeding time scale from the lump.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Maybe I'm going too fast here, but yeah, exactly. So what's happening is that once it accretes matter, some part of the matter starts orbiting the black hole, so we will form this mini disk structure. But since the mini disk is, as we see here, since the mini disk is too small, then the inflow time of the matter there will be shorter compared to the next accretion event, right? So so essentially it will deplete most of this mass until the other accretion event. If you go to larger separations, then the truncation radius here is larger, and then the inflow time is also larger, and you won't have this variability so spiky, let's say, right? So yeah, exactly. This is because the inflow time is shorter than the mass of the black hole to the lump.
So then in principle, from this viability, you could somehow perhaps infer what the separation of the black holes is?
Yeah, of course. Essentially, I mean, you have a pretty degenerate system here, but yes, so if you have this variability that comes from the if you're sure that your emission comes from around the black hole, then yes, if you see this variability, you will say, okay, this is a closed separation system. Because if it were in a larger if the separation were larger, then you won't have this variability. So yeah, this could be some signature of a short separation binary in principle. Yeah. Okay. So another interesting feature where you add when you add spin to the black hole is that if you have magnetic fields, you'll have some outflows, given that the Blum-Fortnite process can act here. And the interesting thing, so here I'm showing epiloidal slice of one of the mini disks. So this is one of the black holes, the other will be here, right? So we are following the black hole. And we see that from the beginning of the simulation, this structure merges here. And if you measure the point in flux of this structure, you see compared to the non-spinning case, it will have some jet-like structure. And so this is suspected, of course. And but what is interesting here is that, as I showed before, the accretion rate has this variability that is imprinted in the variability of the electromagnetic luminosity, in the point in flux, right? So if this point in flux is somehow converted into radiation, then you could, in principle, connect this variability with the variability of the accretion rate, and that is related to the binary. So this could be, again, another possible signature of a binary system. Right. Okay. So these were the simulations, and what we are doing actually right now is to take the data of the simulation and use ray tracing to compute light curves and spectra. So we are using this code written by Scott Novel called Bothers. So Bothers essentially takes the data from the simulation. We are implementing in the simulation a cooling function. So we capture how much radiation is emitted in each cell, and we take that to transform that into sort of a proxy for radiation. So we are using that, and we apply that for to essentially two regimes, the optically thin and optically thick, that will correspond to a low accretion phase system and a high accretion phase system. And we are computing this, essentially we are solving the radiative transport equation in the system. And so we can have like images here, like nice images of the corona in this case, of the black holes, and also synchrotron radiation. So even though, you know, the prescriptions for this emission is kind of a toy model of the real emission, the interesting thing is we can explore variability and you know, orders of kind of estimates of how the light curve and the spectra will behave, right? So first, let me show you a video of what the optically thick emission, so the thermal emission, and the thermal emission of the system will look like. And so we can, this is since it's optically thick, we need to see this in phase on. So we are, this is a view of the system that is above the whole disk. We can see here how the spectra and the different components of the spectra evolves in time. So you can see the mini disk variability here, and the emission of the circumbinary, and other features. Here is the corona of the system that, again, we model with some prescription for the inverse Compton. And with this results, we're trying to then connect this with different with what are the most promising observables and this different types of electromagnetic signatures. And so in the case of the optically thin, we can also explore what are the variabilities of the system giving kinematic effects. So here is here's a model of what the system will look if you see it edge on, right? So the emission here comes from the corona around the black hole. And so you can see here that the luminosity has these spikes that comes essentially from the self-lensing of the system. So, this is a nice, and also here we have the prescription of how the gas emit, because we have the simulation. So it's still, the radiation is not self-consistent, but we can see this, nice effects of self-lensing and how they would look like on a real system. So this is what we are investigating right now.
So can I ask a quick question? So for yep. the corona, so you're essentially just assuming you have some electron positron plasma with some power law distribution.
Yeah, exactly.
Or so, and then you just upscatter the thermal photons and you get this inverse Compton bump, or is that the idea?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, more or less that. We're not doing any. So this is all local, right? So we are not doing any Monte Carlo calculation here, right? So this is all a prescription that you can take locally for each point at each time slice. But we are not currently doing the full scattering of the photons or whatever. This will be. Yeah. This is a next project, perhaps. But as I said, so this is something we can do since we have since we have the simulation data and we have the ability to explore the different the different angles of viewing the system and all. So it's still valuable information to have, you know, how the kinematic effects of the photons and the space time will come here. So yeah. All right. So yeah. So this is everything I wanted to show about the supermassive binary black holes.
May I also ask a question here? So
the
plot that you're showing, you said it's for thermal emission, right? So do you have any study on the, let's say, non-thermal emission, let's say in the radio band? Do you have any prescription for the emission in the radio band?
So we are working on that. We have a very toy model prescription of the synchrotron here. So you can see here that that you have the essentially the jet structure from the black hole. So here we are using like a Kirchhoff law to model the radiation there. But we are not. Doing much about that yet. So we are mainly working and analyzing the thermal emission.
Yeah, I mentioned this because, I mean, this system is one of the main targets for next generation Event Horizon telescope. So if you have, if you have this emission model and somehow they can use that to compute this visibility within radio interferometry, and that's very can be very useful. As we can chat about that after your talk. Yeah,
of course. Yes. This is something that it's really interesting. Just wanted to show this is again something preliminary, but since we have the simulation data, we can have some. Proxies for how the emission will look like, and we're planning to reach more complex parts of the emission. So this is what I wanted to show about the system. Sorry if I were too fast. We can chat, of course, after if you have questions. And now I want to present what we've been doing with Daniel. We've been studying QR MHD simulations of neutral star mergers. And in particular, we are focusing on the signatures of the dynamical ejecta and the what the so-called precursors of the merger that we can observe. And the systems are quite different from supermassive binary black holes. The electromagnetic emission will come in transients, in thermal transients like in Alona, and in other non-thermal transients like afterglows and short gamma ray bursts. And my cats are crazy, so if they if they throw off into the ground, sorry. As I was saying, the emission is quite different, and but we still have a multi messenger compact merger here. So there are some ingredients of the modeling that are similar, and so in binary neutron star mergers, we have different phases. Of the whole process of merger, with the end product of either a black hole or a long-lived remnant, and in these different stages of the merger and the post-merger, we will have different outflows from the systems, and this neutron-rich outflow is what will give at the end the electromagnetic radiation. So there are still many many open questions on this, and and questions that we can only address with essentially with, again, with simulations, because we have all these nonlinear phenomena that interplays in complex ways. So we need simulations, and we need simulations that are that have enough detail here, right? So there are still many open questions, even though, you know, there's been a huge amount of literature in the last 5 years or so. And these are just a few questions that we started to explore with Daniel. So basically we want to know, what are the signatures of the fast ejecta that comes from the merger. So as I said before, you have different types of ejecta in the merger. And we want to know what are the signatures of this fast ejecta, computing them in the most, let's say, self-consistent way possible, right? Because again, we need accurate models to compare with possible events, multi-messenger events that will come in the next couple of years. And also there are still some open questions about the only observed multi-messenger event that we have, GW17Y17. So in our work, we are doing, again, gRMHD simulations. Here we are solving Einstein's equations coupled with the fluid. And the new thing here is that we are incorporating neutrino transport. So we are, even in an approximated way, we are accounting for how neutrino is emitted and absorbed. And we are using realistic equations of state, different equations of state, because the end product of the merger will be very determined by the nuclear equation of state. And then we are including also magnetic fields, which are extremely important for the pulse merger evolution of the system. And we're also including as a way of a diagnostic, a lot of tracer particles in the simulation. So we are doing, of course, a grid based simulation, but we are including these tracers to understand the different components of the fluid. And so we are currently finishing our first work here, where we analyze the dynamical ejecta. So Daniel, I don't know how much time I have. If maybe I can...
maybe five to 10 minutes left.
All right. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. I overpassed you with the first part. Yeah. Okay. So in the first part, we are studying the dynamical ejecta, and we wanted to understand better some of the mechanisms that produce these dynamical ejecta. Even though, you know, the qualitatively this is already understood, but we wanted to to fill a lot of gaps that are in the literature about this. So we are studying how this part of the ejecta behaves. So essentially what's going on here is that if you have some equation of state that is soft, so the system is pretty compact with respect to a fixed mass, then the merger will be very violent, right? And in this violent collision of the stars, you will have very violent bounces, right? In the post merger. So we saw that these bounces generate shocks through the system, which is something that was already known, but what we saw is that this shock bounce generated this shock wave that essentially reprocessed part of the material, the neutron-rich material in the system. So you end up with the electron fraction that is not axis symmetric, which is interesting. So we explore the more stiff equations of state, and when we saw that it didn't produce this non-axis symmetry, which is interesting. And then we analyzed the fast ejecta. So we saw that in these strong bounces, when you have the soft equation of state, you have in the first two bounces, you have this fast ejecta that is moving at a speed larger than 0.6. So this is a small component of the ejecta, but non-negligible. And what we did next is, since we had all these tracer particles following the fluid, we could use these tracers to essentially, as initial data, to evolve a nuclear reaction network that, in this case, we use Skynet. And we can compute abundances for the different equations of state simulations. And another thing that we can do with this results is that we can compute the heating rate by the nuclear products of the ejecta. And we saw that if this fluid moves very fast, then it will avoid the capture neutron capture. So in that case, you will end up with free neutrons. And these free neutrons will decay, and this can power essentially an early UB transient. And this was proposed essentially by Metzger in 2015. And this could give you like an early transient in the UB that you can detect a few hours after the merger. So in our work, we try to find self-consistent how many of these free neutrons we had, and we also computed the light curves from this ejecta. So for that purpose, we built a kilonova semi-analytical model. So we took the results from the simulation and we put it in our kilonova code, and we solve for the light curve. And what we saw is that the amount of free neutrons that we have from the simulation will give you like an order of magnitude enhancement of the total luminosity. So I'm missing the y-axis here, but this is total volumetric luminosity. And we also incorporate relativistic effects that are usually neglected. And we also saw that this will again push the total luminosity by a factor of 8 or so. So with all these elements, this is interesting because you can say okay, you're expected to see some signal a few hours after the merger, and not only the later part. So we are now trying to also get afterglow light curve from this ejecta. This is what we are working now. And we also studying the post-merger evolution phase, but I will perhaps go directly to the takeaways. So these are the two projects I've been working on: simulations of spinning supermassive binary black holes, and simulations of binary neutron star mergers. And they are both multi-messenger systems with very different properties and very different elements that you have to take there. But the common player here is general relativity, and I think in a few years this will be even more exciting to to keep working on this. So this is essentially what I wanted to tell you. So yeah, thank you.
Great, thanks so much, Luciano, for a very nice talk. Questions?
Yeah, I have one.
Yeah.
Yeah. So thanks for the nice talk. Yeah, just kind of a technical question. So, I guess tracking this ejecta from binary neutron star mergers is, you know, kind of notoriously difficult to get kind of you know, a really good converged measurement of. So do you have kind of an estimate on the error bars for this even smaller like high velocity component to it?
So what we did that so far that I don't know if that would answer your question, but what we did is we studied the mass distribution of the tracers, and we compare that with the mass distribution that we get if we put like a spherical detector in the grid, right? And yeah, I don't have the plug here, but essentially we compare the mass and will be something like mass and let me see if I can I write here? So we have like mass as a function of histograms of mass as a function of, let's say, electron fraction, and mass as a function of velocity and all that. And we compute that with the tracers. And then we compare that with what we get from essentially putting a spherical detector around the system in the grid, and we saw that that they compare pretty well. But besides that, we haven't done any like measure of the errors or
yeah. Maybe asking even just a simpler question that. So for the amount of ejecta that you were getting at velocities above 0.6 c, that was like 10^-3 or something, solar masses or something. So just wondering, like, kind of what the uncertainties are on that amount of ejecta.
Right. What I did is I compared that in different resolutions. In different resolutions, and also I compared in different detectors, and there is an error bar that is pretty large. When you lose resolution, it changes a bit the amount of fast ejecta. So that's a good question. We will have to somehow put those error bars into the Likerts at the end, I guess. Maybe it's a factor of in resolution it was a factor of perhaps 2 or 5, yeah, closer to 5. Yeah, sorry, I don't have the plus here, but yeah.
Yeah, but is it something where you add more resolution you get more ejecta, or is it the other way, or is do you have like a consistent trend?
So it was kind of surprising that when we check the total amount of mass, we saw that there was convergence. So there was convergence at the, you know, when you increase the resolution, you have more mass until it saturates. But I haven't done that with the fast ejecta yet. Yeah. So I cannot say if there's a like a trend, and we have put the very low atmosphere at the bottom, almost at the bottom of our equation of state. So we cannot go any further down of that.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, I don't see any other hands up. So let's thank Luciano again. We perfectly made it on time, 1:58. Thanks a lot, Luciano. Thanks everyone for attending, and see you all next week, same time, same place.